This is the No Dogma podcast. I'm Brian Hogan, and I'm at the DraftKings offices in downtown Boston today, joined by CTO Jason McGuinness. Thanks for joining me, Jason.
Thanks for having me.
Can you tell me a little bit about your background, please?
Sure. So I was born and raised in Boston. I went to school at Worcester Polytechnic Institute. There I met a co-founder of DraftKings named Paul Lieberman, as well as another architect at DraftKings named Blake Dunkel. Once I graduated from WPI, I went to go work at a company called Vistaprint, where I met some other future co-founders of DraftKings. Once I left Vistaprint, about a year afterwards, I was asked to come here as the CTO, and have been here ever since.
So can you explain a little bit about what DraftKings is?
Sure. So DraftKings takes the fantasy sports concept and reduces season-long play down to a single day. So on our website, you can compete against other players for cash prizes. And our game is a skill-based game where the player who picks the athletes who do best in a single day's event win.
Question that often comes up, I imagine, is why isn't this considered gambling?
Sure. So it's actually a pretty interesting story. The legislation that regulates online gaming, called the UIEGA.
UIEGA.
It makes the distinction between a game of skill and a game of chance. And so a game of skill is something where the outcome is determined by a preponderance of skill as opposed to chance, like flipping a die or flipping a coin or rolling a die. And beyond that, it goes on to exclusively say that games of skill are legal, and by the way, fantasy sports is a game of skill. It's actually directly as what's called a carve-out.
So a carve-out is, it's excluded from the whole gambling. Is that in every state or in most states?
So what the legislation says is it is illegal to facilitate financial transactions online for games of chance. It's a federal offense. So the UIEGA says for fantasy sports, federally, from the federal perspective, fantasy sports are allowed. You may still have problems with specific states, but it's not a federal offense.
So fantasy sports, I get the impression, have been growing enormously over the last few years. I think Yahoo was one of the big companies in initially. How then did DraftKings find a way of coming into a fairly established industry?
Yeah, so DraftKings launched their website in the spring of 2012. So it's about almost 3 years ago now to the date. And at that point in time, we had a few main competitors. One company called Draft Street, which we would go on to purchase in the summer of 2014, as well as another company called FanDuel, which is our primary competitor today. And they had already been in the space for 3 or 4 years or so. So the daily fantasy sports industry was already, you know, established. We weren't first to market. And like you said, there were already several very large players in the season-long space, both Yahoo, CBS, ESPN. But none of them had entered into the daily fantasy market.
So you said you were launched only a little under 3 years ago?
I think April 2012.
I was at a talk by your CEO a few weeks ago, and he was saying that you've grown to approximately 140 people or something like that.
Yeah, pretty crazy growth.
Huge growth in a very short time.
Yeah, it's been quite a ride.
What percentage of that then, let's say, revolves around development? Because we're going to get into a whole software development lifecycle and what you do.
Sure. So there's about 25 to 30 people who work either developing software, testing software, doing deployments, technology management within the organization. Right.
So then 100 people or over 100 people are non-technical.
Correct.
What would their, just briefly, their roles be?
Sure. So a large percentage of DraftKings employees are customer service representatives.
Of course, because you face customers more so than a lot of companies.
Yeah, absolutely. And other roles are obviously, you know, marketing, people who are buying advertisements, creative, people who are building the advertisement pictures, as well as people who are in finance, both fraud operations as well as accounting, and also product operations. So these are the folks who responsible for posting salaries on our website, deciding how big our contest should be, what the prize structures of our contest should be. People who are in analytics, so they're looking at how is our media spend doing, how are people progressing through the site, how do our conversion funnels look.
So if we go to your development life cycle, a lot of companies haven't experienced the kind of growth you have. Or if they have, they haven't been able to control how they've grown. What's your approach been?
So it's definitely a huge challenge. Pretty much all the challenges that I face today on a day-to-day basis are all about scale. Either scaling the organization, scaling our technology, scaling our process. We don't have one approach. You know, over the course of 3 years, our approaches have evolved to match the size of our organization at the time. One thing that really adds perspective is if you look back at the DraftKings technology department, even a year ago, it's seven people or so, and now we're 25 to...
Only a year ago.
Yeah. So that type of growth really sort of stresses all sort of the development practices that you do.
Even hiring.
Even hiring is, you know, extremely time-consuming and critical part of, you know, part of growing a successful company. So I can talk through a little bit of how we're operating now.
Yes, please.
And the development lifecycle now is an agile process. And obviously that's a pretty common approach to developing software right now, but it's, I think, not a process that comes easy. It takes a lot of work to transition from a company that operates, you know, as basically a team of individuals from a development perspective when you only have four or five to a company that's operating at four or five distinct agile teams. So over the course of 6 months or so, we've been working a lot on how do we optimize this agile process and how do we modify agile scrum process to best suit our needs. So we have a, like I said, five or six agile teams. Teams are composed of a technical lead, 3 to 4 developers, a dedicated QA resource, and one person on the team plays the role of the scrum master. We do 2-week sprints, try to empower teams to do as much of the development process within their team structure as possible. So deployments, operations, monitoring, prioritizations. Our teams are aligned to domains, to technical areas. One key problem that we were having as a function of our growth is if you look at the average tenure, of course, of a developer at DraftKings, it's less than a year. You know, it's about 6 months. So one problem that we have in terms of developing software is domain knowledge. We have very talented software developers, but they're not intimately familiar with our systems. So we made the decision, instead of aligning our agile teams with projects, to align them with technology areas.
Did you have to bring in any skills from outside to help you getting this agile process started?
We did. We brought in an agile coach, someone from the Boston area, and they've been very helpful in sort of giving us a heads up on, you know, what are the types of problems that other companies have had and what are the types of solutions that they put in place and how do they work and how do they not work. I think it's important to lean on other expertise and people who have gone through the process before.
And was that someone that came in for a kind of a fixed period, or are they still with you?
So we brought them in for a fixed period to do an assessment and sort of deliver a report on where our major gaps were and potential solutions to close those gaps. But we've kept them on an ongoing basis to review progress against that plan and to continue to keep them engaged in our development process.
One role I didn't hear you mention, and maybe I missed it, was that of a product manager, someone bringing the requirements of the business to the development team.
Yeah, so we don't have a centralized project management office. Agile teams work directly with a product owner, and there's a collaboration there between the technical leads and the product owners in terms of what their priorities are and how much can be fit into a sprint. We try to cut out the project management step as an as an intermediary between technical people and, you know, the ultimate stakeholders and business holders.
And so you have, you said, about 5 to 6 teams. Do they align with different products, or would multiple teams serve one product?
So we've aligned them with sort of technical functions. I can explain.
Sorry, you said, of course, yeah. Not domain, it's yeah. More skills. Sorry, technical. Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, so for example, we have a team called our financial operations team. And what they own is our deposit flows, our withdrawal flows, getting money into the site and out of the site from a user's perspective. They also own software that supports our fraud analysis. Fraud is an area that DraftKings has to be very on top of. They also own sort of our internal accounting process of moving money from a user's account into a contest account, for example.
Mm-hmm. Can we turn now maybe to your tech stack? What are your primary choices in this?
Sure. So the website is written on .NET. It's ASP.NET MVC. And developers write C# on a daily basis here. Some other technologies that we're using. We're using a open source fork of service stack called NServiceKit to develop RESTful services. Our primary data store is a MySQL database running on within Amazon's RDS system. So DraftKings is hosted entirely within Amazon Web Services.
And for a new company, it's unusual to see you picking .NET mm-hmm. as your primary tech. Most companies are not going that way. Mm-hmm. What led to that decision?
So the truthful answer is that the co-founder who initially created, you know, DraftKings and the very first version of it was a technical person, but had never written software professionally in their life. So they made the choice of going with .NET because that was what they were familiar with from working at Vistaprint, which was a .NET technical stack. And it was the stack that the people that they knew were familiar with.
I see. So you could recruit more easily.
Exactly.
Bring your friends in. You don't have to learn something crazy.
Yeah. So that's probably the most honest answer to the rationale question. But that being said, I've written in .NET for over 10 years now. And there's, I think, a lot to be said about the maturity of C# as a language and how it's been evolving over the past 10 years, say, as comparison to, say, Java, yes. which has been much more static, I think, in yes. its evolution. Visual Studio as an IDE is a great IDE.
I started using Eclipse back in the late 90s, and it's sort of, yeah. I don't think it's improved enormously since
yeah.
then.
And debugging within .NET is great, particularly when you add static analysis and refactoring tools are fantastic. We use a tool called ReSharper on top of Visual Studio.
Who doesn't?
And, you know, once you reach a certain scale, from a development team size, I like to say that the compiler is your most productive developer. I think that operating in a system at the size of DraftKings' code base now, having a compiler is a very, very productive part of the process.
You mentioned though that you're using MySQL, and that is a little bit unusual with yeah. a .NET mm-hmm. stack. What was the decision there?
Cost savings, mostly. You know, before DraftKings raised its first fundraising round, there were just three co-founders in a spare bedroom, trying to scratch together a prototype and show it to investors. So for 6-9 months or so, they were running a version of this site that you know, they were paying for out of their own pockets. So they eventually chose MySQL for cost-saving reasons.
So the way your company has obviously grown enormously over the last few years, your traffic and your customer base must have grown enormously too. Mm-hmm. How do you deal technically with that scale?
So scaling technology over the past couple of years has been pretty much the greatest challenge for my team. And the important thing is to recognize that scale is, you know, of scaling the technology is the utmost importance. Regardless of how many products and features we have on our site, if the site's not up, it doesn't matter, right? Being at a company that is experiencing 10x year-over-year growth basically means that investing in technology becomes pretty much the primary focus of the development team. So the way we approach scale is the same way we would approach a new feature development. We talk about what our bottleneck is, what our current metrics and SLAs within that area are, what they need to be 6 months from now. DraftKings year revolves around the kickoff day of football. So
that's, football is the biggest one.
Yep, that's our Cyber Monday, so to speak. So in early September, we expect that DraftKings is going to have a 10x growth function, step function, in the size of the business and our metrics day over day. So we as technologists don't benefit from this sort of nice gradual ramp up over time from here to September. It's going to be, if it's 1 on September, I forget what it is this year, 7th, it's going to be 10 on September 8th.
And then we'll maintain that 10 until end of January?
We'll grow significantly over the course of the NFL season. It's a great acquisition engine for the company. Right now, all DraftKings developers are in the midst of re-examining all of our software systems against sort of the projections of what the site needs to accomplish in come September. And you know, like I said, we're approaching it from a sort of metrics-based perspective of what do we need to be able to do, say, for example, how many entries per minute do we need to accomplish? We look at what we did last year, look at what we're thinking we want to do now or will actually achieve in come September. We double it, and that's sort of our support goal. And then it's just, you know, given where we are, what is the technical changes that need to be made in order to get us from here to there? We break it down into sprints and start executing on that vision.
And then is a lot of that infrastructure or coding?
Both. So we were running last NFL season at peak, maybe 40 web servers. So these are just front-facing web servers. So we need to figure out what does the infrastructure look like, you know, next year if we don't get any efficiencies that allows us to operate a site that has 400 web servers. Now, being in Amazon's cloud obviously gives us sort of tremendous elasticity in our physical presence, and we take advantage of that. So the DraftKings physical infrastructure will scale up by orders of magnitude during the course of the day and then scale back down in order to align with expected volume. So for us, sort of the physical infrastructure, the challenges there aren't actually buying the computers and shipping them off into a data center and installing them in a rack. It's more what you may have done to operate a website that had, say, 10 machines behind a load balancer doesn't necessarily work when you bump that number up into the hundreds. But the biggest challenges we have are from the software perspective. DraftKings is in the midst of transitioning ourselves from a sort of single database architecture using this large MySQL database to a microservices architecture, allowing us to distribute our data and our transactions and queries across, you know, more database servers.
Can you explain a bit more about your migration to a microservices architecture?
Sure. So from a technology perspective, what we're migrating to are web services, like I said, written using NServiceKit as the web server framework and as the service framework. The interesting or hard part of the problem isn't so much for us, at least, deciding which service framework we're going to use. It's all in definition of domain. Which services do you have? What are they responsible for? What are those services' scaling characteristics? How do they fail? What happens when they fail to your site? How do you operate on these services? What happens when they fail? Who needs to get notified and at what level of urgency? So this is, I think, pretty common advice when you start to learn about microservices, is that what you're effectively doing is you're trading complexity of software for complexity of operation. And getting ahead of that to the extent that you can is really key for a successful migration towards microservices. We already have a handful of them out the door and deployed, and you know, we're learning these lessons firsthand that one of the biggest things that you need to do in order to ensure a successful microservice release is have a very solid release plan, deployment plan, and post-deployment operations plan for that piece of software, because it is effectively another, you know, version of your website that is owning some concern. So those are sort of the main challenges with microservices. In terms of what we're seeing as the benefits, in some respect, getting operating a microservice is easier in that its footprint to the world is much more constrained. And we can do load testing against a microservice much easier than we can against a ESP.NET, you know, MVC website. We have very defined contracts. We have, and those contracts and those endpoints have very defined sort of performance characteristics. And that gives us a way to assert with confidence that we're going to be able to handle projected NFL volume.
And easier for a deployment or a fix because it's just one service as opposed to a whole site.
Yeah, absolutely.
And
so,
testing as well.
You know, like I said, we have 5 or 6 Agile teams right now. And being on a single piece of software, our main website, what we were seeing that was causing a friction within the development process is that each of these Agile teams were competing in order to get on what we call a train, in order to be shipped out to production. And some teams were sort of calling a timeout and saying, no one else can get on the train this day because I have something going out that's a little bit higher risk and I need to be able to, you know, effectively operate the site without any other variable in play. So moving to a microservices structure where all of these services are independently deployable definitely alleviates those types of deployment problems.
So would something like the more, I suppose, what's vogue now, the DevOps approach, mm-hmm. is that something that would help your deployment, your build, your coding?
Right. Yeah, so the approach that we're taking is to actually embed DevOps within each team. So again, our philosophy is that an Agile team should be able to conceive of and ship software to production without having to ask anybody else outside of the team structure. So what that means is you need to have somebody on the team who owns sort of the operations of that software. How do I get it to prod? What do we alert and monitor on? We're using a software product called Datadog, which allows us to create customized dashboards for each one of these microservices. And that's another sort of key part of the release and deployment plan. But the key thing is, again, is it's not going to happen unless it's someone's job to do it. And having a centralized sort of release function creates another bottleneck. So embedding DevOps within the team allows them to prioritize given their own sort of constraints.
In an earlier podcast, I spoke with Igor Muchnik of Constant Contact mm-hmm. just about DevOps, and he was saying the same thing. He views his role as to set up the kind of the procedure, then train the teams, and then they perform the task themselves. And they'll get assistance, but mm-hmm. they have to do it for themselves mm-hmm. from the kind of the first project onwards.
Exactly. So the concern if you completely decentralize the operations side of the fence is, where is that knowledge sharing coming from? Like, how is your best DevOps person going to help your new DevOps person if they're on different teams? So our approach there is to have smaller centralized functions that have dotted line relationships with DevOps throughout the entire organization that sort of serve as guilds, so to speak, of the DevOps function. And they share sort of best practices and ensure standards are being met and ensure consistency in delivery.
You mentioned service level agreements a few times tonight. Can you explain why the SLAs are so important to your company?
Sure. So DraftKings is dealing with money. People have money on their account, and they're wagering money in the contest that they enter. So if the DraftKings site is not available, people may not be able to A, at the top line, enter into the contest to compete against players, but and B, be able to modify their rosters and their lineups up until the time that the individual athlete starts, so that they're actually competing with, you know, the roster that they want to compete with. And obviously, if the site isn't up and people aren't able to do that, then, you know, we're not doing our job of providing the best gaming experience that that we can. So the things that we're obviously trying to prevent against, in addition to customer dissatisfaction, is having to give refunds to customers for service disruptions, just making sure that the site is always up, available, fast, reliable, and trustworthy.
What kind of tools do you then use, say, to monitor the availability of the site? Do you have to use things for different regions? Because, great, it's working in Boston. Mm-hmm. Do you need to be sure it's working in Seattle at the same time?
Sure. So we have a variety of tools that we use to monitor the site. I had mentioned once already Datadog, which we use to stream in various metrics about our site into that platform, which you can then set up alerts on. We also use a company called PagerDuty to alert us when certain events happen. PagerDuty can fire basically whenever you send a specific email address an alert. So we have software that's running SQL queries around the clock, a large variety of them. And if it picks up any sort of weird discrepancy, it will email out. It will email to PagerDuty, and a developer on call will get paged. We also, with regards to the region question, we use a company called Pingdom to keep track of the performance of our website from not just within the U.S. but around the globe. And that site will also trigger alerts if SLAs drop to a certain, drop below a certain threshold.
You mentioned earlier the term expected volume. What do you do in the instance of, let's say, some big sports news breaks and, I don't know, a bus full of football players is in a crash and everyone's worried their player has a broken foot?
Sure. So that can impact our software in a couple of different ways. Just taking a step back, so we do benefit from having very predictable traffic, in that our spikes, we know exactly when they're coming. They're going to be 5 minutes before the game starts. But within outside of those spikes, and pretty much to date, everything else is, orders of magnitude lower than these sort of expected spikes. The types of things that we see can actually influence traffic in a way that is measurable and important are things like injury notifications. So if a certain player gets announced, say in basketball, say LeBron James was a late scratch, that would trigger a massive influx of traffic to DraftKings to change rosters before the game started, because anybody who had LeBron James before he was scratched isn't going to get any points for him. So that's something that we can see very measurably in our metrics. But again, it's not something that really compares on the same level as just the expected last minute rush. So we get last minute rushes because we offer a type of contest that's called a guaranteed contest. And what a guaranteed contest is regardless of how many people join that contest, DraftKings is going to pay out the full prize pool, to whoever wins. So if there's a guaranteed contest that doesn't fill, you are getting much better odds than if it did fill. So what we get is a last minute rush of what we call overlay hunters, people who are looking for sort of this economic advantage and joining in at the last minute. The other way that unpredictable events impact our software isn't so much from a load perspective or a scaling perspective, but it's from an operational perspective. I'll give an example. There was going to be a basketball game, I believe it was a basketball game, hosted in Mexico City a year ago. And the game was canceled because the stadium caught fire. So what does that mean to all the thousands of people who had come to DraftKings and had drafted players from that game? It means, A, they need to be notified. B, we need to make sure that our scoring software and such takes this into account. Other things are like MLB rain delays, like what happens when a game goes 6 hours later than it needs to be. Finally, things like in college basketball, for instance, those games actually start early sometimes. So what does that mean when you think a game is going to start at 1 o'clock, but stats start coming in for it at 12:50? We need to take steps to ensure that people who haven't drafted yet aren't receiving an advantage from knowing about 10 minutes of play. So there's a really interesting aspect to developing software that interacts with real-world events and having to basically predict the unpredictable.
You just mentioned there about the data coming in 10 minutes early, and that's the next question I wanted to get to. Where does all the data about the sports events and the people come from?
Sure. So we partner with a company that's very creatively called Stats Inc., and what they do is they provide stats on real-world events. They have a variety of ways that your software can interact with their web services, either web service, web sockets, FTP pull. And DraftKings interacts with them, and our goal is to interact with stats, pull down information about a sporting event that's happening in real time, push it into our system, calculate how it changes our scores and our ranks and our time remaining, and send it out to the user over a WebSocket, and do all of this in a time that beats the broadcast delay. So
how long is the broadcast delay?
About 7 seconds.
Okay.
So Stats has have people actually at every event, and they're plugging away at...
So those are the guys sitting on the laptops at the Celtics game.
Yep. And a lot of the feeds that they get are actually the official feeds from the leagues. But, not all sports that we cover are provided by Stats. We offer MMA on site now, and that's not something that Stats offers. So we use another data provider as well. So this, the system is architected to support sort of a plethora of data providers.
So you're integrating with multiple, pulling all the information in.
Yep.
So on that topic of analytics, you mentioned that you have a team of an analytics team. Where do you use all that data?
Sure. So they're sort of largely divided along the axis of monitoring how people are coming to the site and how acquisition is doing, and then monitoring how people are using the site and how we're doing from a retention perspective. And then finally, many of them are working on sort of what we call our contest sizing team. So if you hit the DraftKings homepage, what it is a list of contests that you can join. And each of these contests have a different amount of possible players that you'll compete against. They have an entry fee and they have a prize structure. And the contest sizing team is responsible for making sure that that mix of contests is optimized in order to, it's optimized for revenue, that we're putting out a guaranteed contests that are both engaging, but also, will fill, and that it's diverse and that there's something at every level.
Does the analysis from that team feed into your development or any of your, let's say, scaling?
Not so much from a scaling perspective. It does feed into development. We talk to that team to understand how people are using the site and how particularly our power users are using the site.
Okay, no, fair enough. So one thing, Paul, your CEO, he made a comment that you have partnerships, I think, with Mohegan Sun and Caesars Palace.
Mm-hmm.
So this is kind of a privacy issue. You have a lot of data about a lot of people, potentially their, not necessarily income, but what they're winning, how much money they, let's say, have on hand in disposable cash, their spending habits, their interests, and their behavior, whether they're a risk taker or not. Do you see this as something where you have to be incredibly careful with the data, or something that's a little bit worrying given your associations with the likes of those two companies?
So obviously we take customer privacy very seriously, and go through great lengths to protect that data. With regard to those particular partnerships, those are advertising partners only. The extent of our relationship is you'll see a DraftKings logo on a poker table, for instance, or signage at their casino. We're not sharing data about how our customers play or where they live or how much money they have on site with those marketing partners.
Now, that would be the thing that I was I wanted to ask, but didn't want to put it so bluntly. So then, what's the future work for you and your team?
Yeah. So obviously, as long as the company continues to grow at the pace that it does, scaling technology is going to remain a primary focus for the technology team. From a product perspective, we're always looking to add additional sports to reach out to a new audience, as well as internationalization. It's obviously a very big market overseas, and everyone's engaged with sports across the world, so there's opportunity for DraftKings there. And then keep in mind that DraftKings is only a company that's 3 years old, so a lot of the product features that we have on site are our first crack at it or our second crack at it, and we feel like we can constantly be optimizing how users use our site to make a more enjoyable game experience.
Any final notes before we wrap up?
Yeah, just DraftKings is hiring across all levels of the organization, from developers, QA, project manager, technical managers. Great place to work, free snacks, two kegs on tap, located right across the street from South Station.
Thank you very much, Jason McInnes.
Thank you.
One, two, four.
The opening music was The Return by Nisi23 from the album 11 and 12, and the closing music was All These Wires Between Us by Lucky Dragons from the album Dark Falcon.